Is the West willing or able to provide Ukraine with artillery?
The answer is, you know, twofold. Willing, apparently not. They're not doing anything. But even if they had the will, where are they going to get the ammunition? It just doesn't grow on trees. It has to be produced. And Europe has acknowledged that they were unable to generate the industrial capacity to produce ammunition in the amounts needed by the Ukrainians. But even if they pass money today, for instance, the U.S. Congress kicks out money, this ammunition still has to be produced. It in some cases would require production lines to be built. We're talking about months before any ammunition could be flowing to Ukraine. It's questionable whether the Ukrainian military will still be able to exist in months' time. So they're suffering catastrophic losses on the battlefield, losses that can't be replaced. And there's no amount of money that can plug that hole.
We've heard during this war, we've heard about the NATO's or the United States high-tech weapons being used in Ukraine that were not suitable for this kind of fight, this kind of war of attrition in Ukraine. Do you think in the U.S., the military-industrial complex is thinking of modifying these kind of systems?
First of all, I don't agree with this concept. I think a weapon system that's placed in the hands of personnel who are trained to use it and who have logistical sustainability, who have tactics and operations geared around the specifications of this equipment will do well in battle. I believe that the United States Army using the M1 tank would perform better than the Ukrainian Army using the M1 tank. It's not about the tank. It's about the soldier. It's about the system. It's about the approach. But the U.S. Army would run into, similar problems, artillery support. Does the U.S. Army have sufficient artillery systems capable to, match or, in the case of the need for victory, surpass those of Russia? And the answer is no. Can we sustain our brigades in combat for a meaningful period of time? The answer is no. It's not about the equipment. We know that good soldiers with outdated equipment can do quite well. We saw this, in Israel's 1956, 1967, even 1973 wars against their Arab opponents. Many of the Israeli reserve units that were sent into battle with old tanks, some of the tanks dating back to World War II. But through audacity, through good tactics, et cetera, Israel was able to prevail. And so if the Ukrainian army, had its act together, had highly trained troops, it doesn't matter that they don't have the newest tanks. Now, there is an argument to be made that since the Ukrainian military was trained on Soviet-era equipment, that it would be best to give them Soviet-era equipment. And I agree with that. One of the big problems here is that we're giving them equipment that they can't maintain, that they aren't familiar with. They don't know how to use. They don't know its characteristics. They don't have maintenance sustainability. But again, that's not the equipment's fault. That's the Ukrainian soldiers' fault. They're just not able to receive this equipment and use this equipment effectively.
When it comes to the Patriot systems and S-300, which is much older than Patriot systems, how do you compare these two kind of systems that were so crucial in this battle in Ukraine?
Again, it comes down to troops. I mean, the Patriot system, first of all, isn't as good as everybody makes it out to be. It's based upon a flawed concept of automated engagement. That dates back to the safeguard system of the 1970s. We took a strategic defense system, the concepts, and we tried to create this tactical system that didn't work. When we've been struggling with it since the beginning. In 1991, during the Gulf War, we saw the Patriot was not effective in intercepting Iraqi modified Scud missiles. We've seen in Saudi Arabia the Patriot not being able to defend strategic locations, and we see in Ukraine that the Patriot just isn't the magic system everybody makes out to be. We have that. The S-300 is a tested system, but it's an old system. It's one that the Russians are very familiar with. What I can say is that the problems faced by these two systems, isn't necessarily a failure of the system, but the fact that the Russians just happen to be very good at suppressing enemy air defense, and they've come up with the appropriate tactics to overwhelm Ukraine's air defense, because Ukraine has other systems, the Iris-T, the NASAMS. None of these systems are working. None of these systems are keeping the Russians from dominating the skies over Ukraine.
When it comes to the production of ammunition, what's the problem that they cannot produce at the same level that Russia does today?
Problem is greed. Look, the United States has the ability to create modern production facilities, and we have the ability to generate large quantities of ammunition. That's not the problem. The problem is that that's very expensive, and the defense industries don't want to engage in activities that minimize their profit margin. They have a way of doing business today that is geared exclusively to making money for their shareholders, and they don't want to deviate from that. Look, the United States could, we saw this during COVID, where the president used special defense production laws to get companies to gear up for the production of ventilators and other things that were deemed to be in the national security interest. The president hasn't used any of those powers when it comes to producing artillery ammunition. They've put out bids, they've made requests, but the defense industries themselves are saying, we need contracts of a certain size, a certain duration. We're not going to go out and put up a new production line just to crank out 1 million rounds and then have to shut it down because the war in Ukraine was over. And the U.S. government's not willing to make that commitment. So the end result is the defense industries refuse to do that which is necessary to increase artillery shell production, et cetera. We go to Russia, and what we see is that the Russian government makes a determination that they need defense industry geared up. And because the defense industry is largely under state control, they do operate under a concept called joint stock companies. And so there is a civilian commercial element. But when it comes to the defense industry, they're responsible to the defense minister and the ministries, of defense industry. And they're held to account. They produce that which is needed in the interest of national security. They're not worried about the bottom line. They're not worried about stockholders, shareholders. They're worried about getting the material to the Russian military of a time of a certain quality and in a certain time frame. Two totally different approaches.
With what we've seen so far, in your opinion, what would be the situation of the western part of Ukraine? We know that we have various ethnicities in that part, Romanians, Hungarians. How do you see the future of the western part of Ukraine if it ends up to be a landlocked?
I think Russia has to be careful not to win the war, but lose the war. And what I mean by that is the whole purpose of this special military operation was to make sure that there was a neutral Ukraine, that NATO couldn't use Ukraine as a springboard against Russia, et cetera. And also to create the conditions for a new European security framework discussion with Europe and the United States. If this war ends and Western Ukraine continues to be a place where anti-Russian ideology can fester and be fostered, where Stepan Bandera is still considered to be a hero, then what has Russia accomplished? Nothing. I mean, they've won a war, they've gained some territories, but this problem hasn't gone away and it will continue to exist. I think Russia wants this problem to be ended. It wants the issue of Banderist ideology to be terminated. And so this is going to require not allowing Western Ukraine to fall under the sovereign control of other nations, but for Russia to ensure that Western Ukraine is purged of all of its Banderist leanings, and cleanse it of this infection. And then afterwards, to incorporate this cleansed Western Ukraine into whatever Ukrainian rump state still exists after the conflict. Belarus has made it clear that it will not tolerate Western Ukraine going to Poland, that poses an existential threat. So, and I think Russia will respect Belarus's, inclinations in this regard. So I don't see Western Ukraine going to Poland. Now there are other ethnic groups. Romania has some claims. Hungary has some claims. On here, I could see referenda taking place that saw the transfer, because we're not talking about Nazi ideology. We're talking about respecting the desires of the for self-determination of an ethnically homogenous people. So the Hungarians would say, we don't want to live under Ukraine. We want to live in Hungary. The same thing with the Romanians. So I think we could see that. But for Western Ukraine, I don't see Russia allowing that to go to Poland. First of all, it would insult Belarus and put the Belarus-Russian relationship at risk. And second of all, it creates the conditions where eventually Western Ukraine could be absorbed by Poland, therefore becoming NATO territory, or the Banderas would never be purged, and they would be there continuing to spread their rot. So I don't see a situation where Russia allows Western Ukraine to become an independent entity.
In Germany, in the United Kingdom, recently in Sweden, they're talking about fighting Russia. How realistic is that?
I think right now NATO is in a crisis. They have said that the conflict in Ukraine is existential for them, that they can't allow Russia to win. Well, Russia's winning. It doesn't matter what NATO wants or thinks or desires. Russia is not only winning, but Russia has won. And so NATO is now struggling to make itself relevant. And it can only do that by postulating scenarios where there will be conflict with Russia, because only by postulating those scenarios can they argue for the increase in defense spending that would be necessary to rebuild the alliance militarily. The good news is that every single one of the NATO war narratives involves Russia attacking NATO, and Russia is not going to attack NATO. But what NATO needs to realize is, regardless of whether it's a Russian attack or a NATO attack or whatever, a war with Russia will not be anything like the conflict that we see in Ukraine. I mean, right now, NATO is under the impression that that's the war they'll be fighting. That's why they're talking about, a 300,000 person rapid response force, rearming, re-equipping, et cetera. They're doing this large exercise this summer. So, but the war between Russia and NATO won't be done fought by conventional means. It'll be fought using nuclear weapons. And Dmitry Medvedev, the former prime minister and former president of Russia, currently deputy head of the Russian National Security Council, has said that if there's a war with NATO, basically Russia will use nuclear weapons and destroy NATO, destroy everything about it, destroy every city. That's the reality of a Russian-NATO conflict. The good news, again, is that NATO's war rhetoric is predicated upon a Russian attack against NATO that will never come. So it's basically loud words. But the problem is, if NATO continues to not only posture rhetorically about the potential of conflict, but begins to actively prepare for potential of conflict, you could create a scenario where one mistake, one miscalculation leads to the initiation of action that then results in a war that nobody wanted, nobody was looking for, but now is here, and now everybody dies. So that's the danger. And I think the world needs to wake up, not just Ukraine, or not just Europe, not just Russia, not just the United States, but the world, that what NATO is doing is grossly irresponsible and putting the entire world at risk. And maybe international pressure could be put on NATO so that it stops talking about the need to expand its military capacity and instead starts talking about, what it takes to create a new European security framework where Russia and NATO, Russia and Europe can live side by side in peace.
Many people are arguing that if NATO goes to war with Russia, they're gonna smash Russia because they're comparing GDP of these countries, the size of military, the weapons, the manpower they have.
Well, first of all, again, if NATO and Russia fight, understand it doesn't matter how much conventional power you have. It's going to be a nuclear war, so you're all going to die. And NATO has no meaningful nuclear capacity. They rely on the United States, to a lesser extent, France and Great Britain. So it's a stupid argument to begin with, a stupid conversation to begin with. But it's there. I recognize that. But let's just look at the fallacy of this. NATO is not a singularity. It's not a homogeneous singularity. What I mean by that is, in the United States, I can take a division from Washington State and move it to Georgia and then move it on to Europe, because America is a singularity. How many Spanish divisions are there, and how many of those divisions are earmarked to fight in Poland? First answer is, I don't know. We'd have to look it up. But the second answer is easy: zero. So let's take Spain out of the equation in any potential future conflict with Russia. There won't be any Spanish forces in Poland. How about Portuguese forces? Nope, none of them either. How about Italians? Nope. How about the Turks? Nope. How about the Greeks? Nope. Do you see what I'm saying? It doesn't matter how many nations are in NATO. NATO is incapable of harnessing the totality of this military potential into a singularity capable of standing up to Russia. If Russia and NATO were to get engaged in a ground combat, it would be either in Northern Europe with Poland, the Baltic states, backed up to a lesser extent by the United States, very small British contingent, very small French contingent, and maybe some German troops. But there won't be any Italians, there won't be any Spanish, there won't be any Portuguese, there won't be any Turks or Greeks. Just those forces. And those nations all have broken militaries that are incapable of generating militarily significant forces. So that's right. Now, let's say we fight against the fights now in Moldova and in Romania. So you have the Romanian army. You may get some Bulgarians, probably not, but maybe some. You'll get some Americans, and that's it. The rest of NATO is not going to deploy to Romania. So what are we talking about here? It's NATO's power exists only on paper. It's not like there's a single NATO military. The military is made up of a bunch of constituent states, each one of whom, have their own commitments. You can't look at the Spanish military and say, oh, because they have 500,000 troops, they can send 500,000 troops to Poland. They have other commitments. They have other national security requirements. So even if they were able to deploy people to Poland, I would imagine they could only generate a couple thousand. That's not game-changing numbers. So the people that talk about NATO being this unbeatable force just don't know what they're talking about.
Putin and Lavrov, they're thinking of negotiations. They were always talking about negotiations to solve the situation, the problem in Ukraine. But in order to have that, we need somebody in the United States, in Washington, who's willing to do that.
Well, I think it's pretty arrogant to think that the United States is going to play a role in negotiating an outcome to this conflict. The United States is a party to the conflict. And they're the side they've chosen is the losing side. What makes anybody think that Russia wants to sit down at the table with the United States or Europe to resolve the issue in Ukraine? Russia tried that already. They tried that in 2022. And it was the United States and England, together with NATO and Europe, that advised Ukraine not to agree to a peace treaty. Now Russia has mobilized. Russia has spent a significant amount of money. They've lost many troops, and victory is theirs. Why would they negotiate that away? What is Russia going to negotiate? They want denazification. That means the end of the Zelensky regime. So they're not going to negotiate with the Zelensky. They want demilitarization, which means the destruction of this pro-NATO army that NATO was built on the soil of Ukraine. Russia's not going to negotiate that away. This war will end when Russia puts forward unconditional terms of surrender that Ukraine will have no choice but to accept. And then the West will have to live with that. Whatever negotiations take place between the West and Russia will take place after Russia defeats Ukraine, after Russia imposes its will on the Ukrainian situation, not before. Why would they sit down and negotiate? That's a defeat. In order to get Russia to the negotiating table, you have to beat Russia. Nobody's beating Russia right now.
I talked with Chas Freeman, Ambassador Chas Freeman. He said that the future of Europe without Russia doesn't mean anything. They need Russia for energy, and industry in Europe needs Russia to be part of their prosperity. In your opinion, how realistic is that?
It's the only outcome. We're seeing a situation where the European people are starting to recognize that they've been taken hostage by their own politicians who don't have the best interests of Europe or the people at heart. So we're seeing farmers come out in great numbers. We're seeing the people becoming disillusioned by the electorate. And, you know, when businessmen sit down and say, under what conditions, for instance, in Germany, can businesses return to Germany? It'll be cheap energy. Right now, they can't afford it because the United States scammed Europe. We blew up a pipeline, and then we convinced them to stop importing energy. And then they had to turn to us, and they're paying exorbitant prices for gas. And you know, the Europeans, that's not sustainable. I think the Europeans will make a decision down the road that there needs to be a new European security framework that allows them to peacefully coexist with Russia. It may be a framework that operates inside the NATO alliance or outside the NATO alliance. It's not going to be dependent upon that. It's going to be dependent upon the desire of the participants for renewed relations, good relations with Russia, inclusive of the ability of Europe to procure Russian energy at affordable prices.
How is that possible for Europe to be independent and a powerhouse?
I think it's... I think to talk about Europe as a powerhouse is unrealistic. Europe's had its moment. The European Union was created. Europe was given an opportunity to build something strong, and yet all they ended up subordinating themselves to the United States. Today, Europe has too many problems. Europe will break apart into its constituent states, I believe. That's the future of Europe. But the notion of this powerful united Europe is a joke. It's a fallacy. It's not powerful, and it's definitely not united. Another problem facing Europe is that because of this multi-decade experiment in creating a European community, people stopped believing in their own national identity. And that's problematic. You have people that probably can't articulate what it means to be a Frenchman, what it means to be a German, what it means to be a Brit. They just know what it means to live in Europe. We'll see what the future holds. I think rise of parties like the Alternative for Deutschland are reflective of the fact that many people, Michel Le Pen has a right-wing party in France. We're seeing Giorgia Moreno, the Italian prime minister, she's from the right, Viktor Orban. We're seeing the rise politically of right-wing parties that talk about defending sovereignty, national sovereignty, not European sovereignty. So I think we're seeing Europe redefine itself as a collective of nation states as opposed to nation states that have come together in a European singularity. I don't see Europe emerging as a powerhouse, and I don't see any European nation being able to, in a reasonable period of time, reverse the deindustrialization that's taking place now because of the sanction of Russia and the kickback. I think Europe has shot itself in the foot, and it's going to have to restructure and redefine itself before it can emerge with any sort of viable economy. And a key aspect of this restructuring and redefinition will, of course, be its energy relationship with Russia.
With the damage that we're witnessing that they're having in their relations with Russia right now, in your opinion, how long does it take to get to the point before this war started?
I don't think we'll ever get to the point where before this war started. The world's changed. Before this war started, Russia was talking to NATO to create a new European security framework. After this war finishes, Russia will have defeated NATO and won't be inclined to give NATO the same consideration that it gave to NATO prior to this war. The same with the United States. I think we're looking at a completely new European-Russian relationship, one that where Europe has to respect the strength of Russia. Back in December of 2021, Europe ignored the Russian outreach for a new European security framework because they didn't respect Russia. They didn't fear Russia. They viewed Russia as a joke. a nation, a gas station disguised as a nation, things of this nature. Well, Russia has emerged from this conflict, having defined itself as not just a regional powerhouse, but a global powerhouse with unmatched military skills and an economy that's booming compared to Europe's economy. Russia is not going to give away everything that it has accrued in a positive fashion over the course of the past 2 years, just to have good relations with Europe. I think that Europe is going to have to redefine its relationship with Russia based upon respect of Russia, and a respect of Russia's sovereignty, and a respect for, Russian national security prerogatives when it comes to spheres of influence in Europe.
I talked with Professor Richard Wolff and Michael Hodson. They were talking about the reason behind this war in Ukraine was the reason that the West had against Soviet Union. They wrecked the economy of Soviet Union by forcing them, by convincing them to put a lot of money in their military industrial complex. So the economy of Soviet Union collapsed. But they were not successful in this policy in Ukraine, and Russia could manage the military part and the economy. You've been in Russia recently. How did you find this?
Well, I'm not an economist and I don't want to play one. So I have to be careful about, getting too far outside of my lane. What I can say is this, though. The Soviet Union suffered from, centralized planning. If we take a look at their ballistic missile production, they produced very good missiles and they produced a lot of missiles, but the mechanism was of pain. The economy of producing missiles wasn't something that the West could readily comprehend. It wasn't that the factory received money for the missile. Like if I contract with Boeing to produce a missile, we have a price marked for each missile, and that price generates funding that then gets budgeted and used to pay salaries, build infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. That's not how it worked. For there was a whole, there's a whole bunch of factors that went in that didn't have direct economic correlations, and so it was unsustainable, especially when the Soviet economy tried to transition away from centralized planning. Into more cost-effective cost accounting, where they had to account for each dollar, where to go to traditional Western style accounting. And what they found when they made that transition is you couldn't sustain the, for instance, the factory city. One of the things about the Soviet Union is when they produced these missiles in Votkinsk, where I was. The factory was responsible for schooling, for the roads, for housing, for social things. So the budget that they received from the state didn't just pay for the missiles, they paid for everything. When you went over to cost accounting, suddenly you're paying for a missile, but there's no money for everything else. So the system started to collapse. So it wasn't that the West caused Russia to collapse. That's just not true. The Soviet Union could very well. If I mean, there's a school of thought today that he, that the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed is because Mikhail Gorbachev precipitously transitioned from Soviet style economy to a Western style economy with no plan on how to do it, and the whole thing collapsed. Had he continued the Soviet style planning, but sought to tighten it up, make things better, not make a direct model of a Western capitalism, there wouldn't have been this precipitous collapse. But he didn't have that vision. He had bought into the notion that the West was better. And next thing you know, you have Boris Yeltsin, the decade of the 90s, and the absolute devastation of Russia because of this. If you take a look at Russian capitalism today, it's a totally different concept, but it's not American capitalism. It's something different. The Russians have a unique economy today. But what's interesting is the West has no clue how the Russian economy works, just like we had no clue how the Soviet economy works. I'm just being straight up honest. The CIA had no clue how the Soviet economy worked. They were just guessing. This is why people like Jeffrey Sachs, who went into Russia in the 1990s, couldn't grasp, what he was trying to fix, because he was coming in with a Western economic planning model that did not translate into the reality of Russia. Russia has emerged from the 1990s. They had to deal with some new artificialities, the rise of an oligarch class that didn't exist during Soviet times had to be factored in. But the saving grace here is that when the West sanctioned Russia in 2022, it was a full divorce, and it forced Russia to do things that politically would have been very difficult to do, like untangle the West from Russian economy, to shut down the oligarchs, to insist on the reinvestment of money in Russia. The West doesn't know Russia's economy today. I mean, I keep telling people that you need to go to the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum every year, so you get an understanding of what makes the Russian economy tick. Nobody wants to go because that's Russian propaganda. No, it's Russian reality. There was an exhibition, I think it's still on for a couple more weeks, the VDHE exhibition in Moscow, that talks about the economic status of all the various districts and republics and oblasts. Each one had their own exhibition platform. And I toured that, and you get to see the diversity of the Russian economy. Again, if you don't see it, you don't know it, you can't talk about it, you can't assess it. And I think that we put too much, we've created a myth about the collapse of the Soviet economy. It didn't collapse the way they say it did. I would challenge them on that. I think that it's far more complicated than just saying that we put so much pressure on them in terms of producing weapons that the system collapsed. No. The system was there, it was working, it wasn't firing on all cylinders. The problem was trying to transition that system to Western style capitalism. That's where the collapse took place, not because we put too much pressure on Russia. And today, the notion that we could pressure Russia, how do you pressure a system that you don't understand? I mean, what points of pressure are you going to push? It makes no sense. We're going to sanction the Russian economy. One of the reasons why sanctions have failed is because they don't know what they're doing. They don't know the Russian economy. They don't know how it functions. They have artificial expectations about, if we cause effect relations, if we do this, this will happen. Well, we did this, that didn't happen, but it backfired on us. I would say that most economists today don't have a clue what the reality of the Russian economy is. I don't have a complete picture of it, but my host that takes me to Russia is a Russian economist. And he spent a lot of time introducing me to the reality of the Russian economy, not just in Moscow, St. Petersburg, but throughout in Novosibirsk, in Irkutsk, Ekaterinburg, Izhevsk, Kazan. And you see the reality, the complexity, the diversity of this Russian economy. There are weaknesses, there are strengths, but my point is we in the West don't understand it because we've divorced ourselves from Russia. We study Russia from afar through a filter that's defined by Western academics who are inherently opposed to Russia, therefore paint everything that happens in Russia in a negative light. Russia is a far stronger economy today than even the IMF, which is supposed to be very good at global economy. They can't get it right. They set a number for the Russian economy for economic growth, and they came back and said, well, we got to increase it, because they don't understand what's happening. They don't understand what's happening. So I think it's too simple to say, we did X for the Soviet Union, this happened, but when we tried to do it with Russia, it didn't happen. You can't make those correlations. Two totally different economic problems, but both united by the fact that the West had no clue what was really going on inside either the Soviet economy or the Russian economy today.